This is the takeaway for Tuesday, July 21st, 2015. This is the takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And the chaos in the Middle East has turned it into a laboratory for a grisly kind of nation building. That's our focus this hour. ISIS is at the center of this nation building experiment, and it's something we're going to talk about in just a moment. And then we'll look at Turkey, a nation state built from the fragments of the collapsed Ottoman Empire a long time ago. We'll discuss the potential for Turkey's destabilization in this current crisis, especially in the aftermath this week of the worst suicide bombing in Turkey since the Syrian uprising began. We begin with ISIS and its intentions and what's going on with its particular brand of statecraft. Documents and communications from within ISIS show a detailed approach to succession. ISIS intends to outlive its current leadership, whether it dies from natural causes or as a consequence of the turmoil in the region or strikes by U.S. forces. Our partner, the New York Times, says that ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi has detailed succession plans, that he's learned from the mistakes of other terrorist groups like al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula, an organization that's been decimated by U.S. drone strikes, particularly in Yemen. Joining us is Eric Schmidt, national security correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Eric, thanks again for joining us.
Hi, John.
It's an interesting window that you're seeing into ISIS through these documents. What kinds of sources and what information are you looking at?
Well, the source documents, John, come from the raid that U.S. Special Operations Forces conducted in late May on the hideout of a top ISIS financier named Abu Sayyaf. And in there, they learned information about the revenue streams that ISIS has, including their how they sell oil, how they arrange their kidnap for ransom payments. But they also learned, as you said, about a little bit more about the structure and hierarchy that Baghdadi has, his top lieutenants in both Syria and Iraq.
Is this a militia? Is this more like a dictatorship? Is there a model here for governance?
Well, what's interesting is he clearly, at least according to most of the sources that my colleague Ben Hubbard and I talked to, he is clearly in charge. He is giving the direction, but he's also pushed and delegated authority down to what's called a ruling Shura Council. It's kind of like a governing cabinet. He has a war minister, an energy minister, things that take care of the day-to-day duties of the Islamic State. After all, they have declared a state. But then he also has a number of former Iraqi army officers, Baathists, who are the military commanders. And then in addition to that, there are regional emirs, kind of local governors, if you will, in Iraq and Syria. So they each are delegated authority following a general description of the priorities that Baghdadi sets.
How centralized is all of this in the city of Raqqa in Syria, where Baghdadi spends most of his time? Or is it distributed out to be less vulnerable to drone attacks and attacks from the air?
Well, the core leadership is in Raqqa, but they've been savvy. They've kind of learned the lessons of previous groups. They've surrounded themselves with civilians. They're in buildings that the United States knows basically where they are, but it is very difficult to hit them without causing a lot of civilian casualties. But as you said, they've also delegated authority out to other commanders who are in different parts of Syria and different parts of Iraq. So if any one of them were killed, a lieutenant would be able to move up and take over those responsibilities, and that applies even to Baghdadi in his headquarters.
Is there a Baghdadi vision here, his particular notion of statecraft, or is it just basically Baghdadi is trying to impose the Quran and that's the end of it?
Well, no, it's certainly the latter. I mean, he is trying to revive the classic caliphate that existed back in the 8th century at this time, and in doing so is calling on Quranic verses and all, and his stature in that. But he's also the statecraft that is involved here involves carrying out the day-to-day workings of a government, such as it is, picking up trash, making sure the lights are on, issuing fishing licenses, as my colleague Tim Arango reports this morning in the New York Times. So there's a number of things that they're trying to do. Of course, they're under pressure with the coalition air campaign and fighting that's going on around them.
How secure is ISIS from this document? Is this aspirational, or do they really have an operation that's working very, very well in terms of revenue, in terms of handing out bureaucratic paperwork of one kind or another?
Well, so far, I mean, it's working as well as you might expect when you have basically the whole world is fighting you. You know, they've set up a state. They actually have people coming to visit, you know, coming to live there. And they do to one extent or the other, depending on where they are carrying out this vision. This is the vision that Baghdadi announced over a year ago. And it's the difference, really, one of the main differences between ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, of course, that was aspirational on the part of bin Laden. He didn't think they were ready for this. Baghdadi says, yes, we are, and we're taking the territory, and we're going to do, despite the attacks that we're coming under, we're going to continue to try and push ahead with our version of what he calls the Islamic State.
The people under Baghdadi, anything about them? Do they have the charismatic style of some of the other leaders in these organizations we've seen since 9/11?
We don't know a whole lot more about them. There's two groups. There are the former al-Qaeda in Iraq militants who've been with Baghdadi for more than a decade. And then there are these Ba'athist former Iraqi commanders that I mentioned. There are two individuals, one guy named al-Afri, who's a former top deputy to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who's the former militant leader in Iraq. And then a second guy, Fadl al-Halawi, also known as Takmani, who's a former Iraqi special forces officers. These are seen as the two top deputies to Baghdadi, and al-Afri in particular is the one who's believed to be the heir apparent. There have been reports that both of these guys were killed in airstrikes over the last several months, but sources I talked to said they probably survived.
Interesting details from inside ISIS, reported there by Eric Schmidt, national security correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks, John.
The ISIS presence in Syria and Iraq has created a multitude of problems for neighboring Turkey, but there has been nothing like the bloody attack in the town of Suruk yesterday. 32 dead, more than 100 injured from a suicide bombing. ISIS targeted a gathering of activists at a cultural center. The Turkish government has allowed some 2 million Syrians across the border as refugees, but until now, it has been reluctant to join the fight against the Islamic State directly. Instead, it has seen Bashar al-Assad's regime as a greater threat. Ian Bremmer joins us now. He's president and founder of Eurasia Group, a global political risk research and consulting firm. Ian, would you say this is a turning point for Turkey in this crisis?
Oh, I don't know if it's a turning point. I mean, I think 2 million refugees in Turkey from Syria is more of the turning point. There's nothing they can do about it. They're paying for it all. They can't get rid of them. And the war is not going to be over anytime soon. There are no solutions in Syria. I certainly think this is going to be a wake-up call in terms of the level of resources they need to put both into security on the border as well as intelligence for those that have made it through.
But Turkey seems to have been trying to raise its profile militarily and strategically in the region, while also playing the question of ISIS versus Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian regime in Damascus, from the middle, that they're not really taking an aggressive fight against ISIS, and it seems like that may have ended.
Well, I think that you're going to see more willingness of Turkey to provide support to the United States for the fight against ISIS, but keep in mind, the United States isn't exactly created a strategy to defeat ISIS. I mean, even in Iraq, it's more of a containment strategy. And in Syria, it's been very limited bombing, and it's been fairly opportunistic. Assad's regime itself has done more fighting against ISIS recently. But if you look at most of the fighting that's going on, it's still sort of Assad versus rebels. And, I mean, as a consequence of that, you know, what you see is generally a power vacuum, and the Turks getting fairly unwilling to be sucked in and still pushing the Americans to take the fight to Assad directly.
What would you say the aspirations of Turkey are at this point with the region so in flux right now? And obviously the first aspiration would be to get the refugees out of Turkey, but after that?
I think the second aspiration is stability. It used to be that Turkey wanted to play a much more dramatic role in the region, but they failed on so many accounts. I mean, they were supporting the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, particularly after Morsi won and former President Mubarak was ousted. That failed badly. They supported Hamas actively vis-a-vis Israel. And then we saw, of course, in the war between Israel and Gaza that the Turks were seen to lose there. They bolstered Qatar to a degree. And Qatar's lost a lot of influence in the region vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia. So the major bets that the Turks have made have largely lost. And, of course, they haven't been able to convince the Americans to do much to actually fight Assad himself. The whole notion of Assad must go is not something you hear a lot from the administration right now. Meanwhile, Erdogan has a pretty significant fight on his hands domestically. in Turkey. He's become more of an authoritarian personality. But Turkey is not an authoritarian state. And the last elections, of course, dealt him a rebuke domestically. So most of his fight is about how he can consolidate his own power, potentially change the constitution to make it more of a presidential system, something the Turkish people are saying fairly decisively don't want to see. And they don't want to see in part because of him.
The border outpost of Gaziantep has grown unbelievably in the 3 years of the Syrian civil war. Is that becoming something like Peshawar in Pakistan? It's a place for refugees. It's a place for armed fighters, mercenaries. It's a place for CIA spies and other clandestine activities to take place. Is it fundamentally a destabilizing phenomenon in Turkey?
It certainly seems that way. I mean, if you look at the numbers and you also look at the lack of governance, I mean, the Turks have done a fantastic job in setting up refugee camps and trying to ensure that no one's going hungry, no one's starving, basic education is happening. But that's very different from saying the Turks have a handle on the backgrounds and the activities of everyone that's actually sitting, both in the refugee camps as well as on the border crossing cities. And the border is very porous. They've had very little control. And they're going to have to try to operationalize that more effectively. They'll clearly be reaching out to the Americans, who is the country that's most capable of affecting them. The Americans, in return, are going to be asking them to do a lot more against ISIS. If you ask me, will we see more cooperation from the Turks going forward on this issue, I think the answer is yes.
Since you do this for a living, what's the risk that Turkey ends up more like Pakistan on the border, and what's the risk for the region if that happens?
You know, it's funny. I had a large group of security advisors from all of the European states in my office yesterday, about 25 of them in all. And I opened up by saying I thought that we talked about global security. I said, well, you know, I think terrorism is a much more dramatic challenge in Europe than it is in the United States. And they got very offended, like to a person, when I said that. And I said, well, wait a second. I said, you've got 2 million refugees in Turkey. And it was very clear that none of the Europeans thought of Turkey as part of Europe. But of course, it is part of Europe. It's a candidate member of Europe, and the migration is relatively easy between those countries. It's going to be a much, much bigger problem. And I think we have to worry about the fact that Turkey itself could be very significantly destabilized. They've done a fantastic job setting up these camps and actually paying for all these people, while the Europeans refuse to take the additional refugees. And of course, the Americans have accepted fewer than 1,000. I think we have to be more aware of just how asymmetrical these challenges are, and Turkey's going to take it on the chin.
Ian Bremmer, president and founder of the Eurasia Group, a global political risk research and consulting firm. Thanks so much, Ian.
My pleasure, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. And LegalZoom, dedicated to providing legal help to all Americans through online services, personal customer support, and legal advice through independent attorneys. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
A 16-year-old kid should never, ever, ever be in that situation. And that's the first outrage. Absolutely an outrage.
That's a judge speaking about the tragic case of a 16-year-old who lost his freedom, lost his childhood, then his sanity, and finally his life for want of $3,000 bail. The Dickensian story of Khalif Browder here in New York City has put the whole bail system under scrutiny. Nationwide, our look this week at the bail system is a series we're calling Presumption of Innocence for Sale. The chief judge of the New York Court of Appeals, Jonathan Lippman, says he's tired of the casino-like atmosphere in the bail system and has made reform a personal mission.
To me, it's totally backwards and makes no sense. And on the one hand, judges are not able to consider public safety as a factor in considering bail, and that's a total fiction and ridiculous. And on the other hand, on the other end of the spectrum, we have people who are incarcerated because they can't make $500 in bail when they're not a threat to society and not really a threat to anybody, not a threat to flee the jurisdiction. So to me, why is it arbitrary? It's arbitrary because we don't change something that doesn't work.
New York City has begun an $18 million initiative to end bail for low-level or nonviolent crimes, which could affect up to 3,000 people who otherwise would be stuck in jail. That's an important step, but in other places in the U.S., judges have found the only effective bail reform is radical reform. It's the story in the District of Columbia, where money bail was completely eliminated in the 1990s and replaced by a system that imposes strong incentives for defendants to show up in court and tough incentives for prosecutors to speed up their cases. Cliff Keenan is the director of D.C.'s Pretrial Services Agency.
So we've been doing this since 1967 in terms of trying to move away from money. But I think it really took hold in 1992 when this city was seeing a tremendous increase in violent crime. Our laws, our bail laws, were not well addressing the need to keep dangerous, violent people off the street. And ever since 1992, we have not used money in Washington, D.C. as a means of bail release.
And what lessons do you learn from that? I mean, how do people hold to agreements and commitments under your system?
Well, it really is a culture change because it didn't happen easily. It didn't happen, immediately. Our system is premised on the presumption of innocence that every arrested person is entitled to. Only people who are a danger to the community, or a danger of not fulfilling their obligation to come back to court. It's a very individualized determination.
At any given time, how many people are awaiting trial in D.C. who are home and free, and what percentage of them actually show up on their court date?
We currently have about 5,000 persons who are out on the street awaiting their trial in court in some pretrial form or other. The vast majority of them are persons that we're supervising here in pretrial, but about a quarter of them are out on straight personal recognizance, so no conditions whatsoever. We keep manually our statistics, and for the last several years, the return rate to court for our population is hovering 90%. So out of all of the persons released, 89 are coming back to court. And significantly, about 89% are remaining arrest-free. So that means that people who are released, because I know there's always a concern about a person being released is going to go out and commit more serious crimes, we're not seeing it. In fact, less than 1% of our population, which is rearrested, is being rearrested on a violent crime.
The people who are designated under preventive detention, where do they go?
Well, let me explain it in a little more detail if I could. If a person is charged with a particular offense, such as a robbery or, a shooting or something very serious, there's a particular statute that gives the government the ability to ask the judge to hold that person as soon as the person is brought in front of the judge. If the judge finds by clear and convincing evidence that the person is, in fact, a danger to the community or a flight risk, then that person is going to be held until their trial. Now, that triggers a speedy trial portion of the statute, which means that the person who has been held without bond under preventive detention must have their trial within 100 days.
So there's no free lunch for a prosecutor. Basically, the judge says, all right, if you're going to hold this person, you've got to have your act together in court in 100 days. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it, right?
Correct. That is correct.
So that's a powerful set of incentives.
No, absolutely. And that's why, I know that people say, well, Washington, D.C. is different. You're quasi-federal. You also have all the resources. But everything that we do is predicated upon a strong statutory framework, which basically puts upon the judge the responsibility to make these decisions about release or detention on an individualized basis.
Is there a case under your system of anyone who's fallen through the cracks? I mean, this is a great system. It sounds fantastic the way you describe it. But what's the longest fall through the cracks kind of scenario in your system, and what can be done about it?
I know years ago when our Department of Corrections was, again, both understaffed and overpopulated, persons who should have been released, might stay incarcerated for an additional period of time, like a month or whatever the case may be. But those were truly rare exceptions. But I also have to say ours is not a system which is perfect, because many people say, well, what happens if a person is released, goes out and does some egregious, heinous crime? And things like that do happen not only in Washington, D.C., but, around the country. In fact, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the case of Maurice Clemens. He was out on bail on some very serious offenses up in Washington State. He walked into a donut shop and shot and killed four sheriff deputies back in 2009, even though he had posted bail through a commercial bondsman. So, again, there is no guarantee if a person is not going to do, what's expected of them. But I think that, ours is much better, and I think it's also something that other jurisdictions can do if they have the resolve to do it.
What do you think is the biggest impediment to making what you do in D.C. more of a national standard?
I think it's fear. to a large extent, you know, judges are concerned that if they release a person into the community and the person does something wrong, they're going to be held accountable. When actually, you know, where they should be held accountable is by making the right decision up front. And the same is true for the prosecutors. I have been a prosecutor, John. 20 years of my career down here in D.C. has been as a prosecutor. And it's very easy for a prosecutor, you know, may be inclined to say, you know what, I'm here to protect the community. I want this guy to stay locked up until, you know, the trial comes. But by detaining a person without the fair due process protections, once again, I think we're doing an injustice to those persons.
Cliff Keenan is the director of the Pretrial Services Agency for the District of Columbia. Cliff, thanks so much.
John, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
In the last century or so, Earth has become a very noisy planet.
The man from space.
If you try to just step away from the Earth, the noise goes down, but it doesn't disappear entirely. Even out at 5.9 trillion miles, a light year away, you alien civilizations out there might hear this radio broadcast from a year ago. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel
like a room without a roof. Radio. Oh, radio.
High out there, but at the speed of light, the farther out you go, the farther back the musical message. So step out 2.351 times 10 to the 14 miles. That's 40 light years. And you would hear this message from Earth.
Love will keep us together.
Yes, the Captain and Tennille weren't just talking to bubblegum easy-listening fans from the 1970s. Their message of, call it, hope, might be heard by anyone who could be on planet GJ1214B.
No.
Did pop singer Carl Douglas understand back in 1975 that creatures staring at a red dwarf sun 40 years into the future might also be trying to figure out what this song is about?
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
Maybe that's not quite the message from humanity we want to send, so we ask you for some suggestions.
This is Michael from Dallas. If aliens were to intercept anything from us, I would like it to be Vivaldi, The Four Seasons, which captures the seasons of the planet quite well.
Well, Michael, first radio broadcast of Vivaldi's Four Seasons was back in 1939. That's 76 light years away by now, where there happens to be a sun-like star, HD 1461, orbited by planet HD 1461b in the constellation Cetus, which could contain water. Message received out there? Well, if you want to go find out what pop music broadcast is being heard at what point right now in the galaxy, you can actually see it instantly if you go to the website lightyear.fm. Mike Locker is the creator of lightyear.fm. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
This is one of those fabulous internet things that's just irresistible and completely pointless, right? I mean, what are you showing here?
We're just showing how far radio waves have traveled out into the galaxy. We were inspired by the opening of the movie Contact, and we thought it would be interesting to do that with, you know, all the music up to now and to make it interactive so people could scroll through and really, like, get a feeling for how big the galaxy is and how far radio waves have traveled.
And since, you know, we've only been doing this radio broadcast stuff for about 100 years on planet Earth, there's not a lot of the universe that's gotten coverage yet. But what have you found that we're actually reaching, places that we're actually reaching?
It reaches out, I think, somewhere, you know, it's a pretty small circle, you know, that like 100 light year radius. So, I mean, we reach out to a lot of, you know, potential planets that could have human life, a lot of stars, and also a lot of vast nothingness.
Is there a particular place that's getting harangued by disco and maybe another place in the galaxy that's hearing a lot of Led Zeppelin?
Yeah, if you look, I mean, you could say, you know, maybe 40 light years out, it's pretty disco heavy. And then, you know, once you get out maybe like 50 light years, it might be more of, you know, a more classic rock scene.
What in terms of history, like programs, do you think are associated with a particular place in the galaxy right now?
Well, I mean, our site only covers the music, but there's certainly, you know, a lot of historic broadcasts. Like if you think, you know, the moon landing is getting figured out by people who are out, what, 50, 60 light years out?
Yeah.
In a few more years, you know, farther away stars will start to figure out that we've just reached Pluto, which is cool.
And the music, how are users interacting with the music? And what are they? I mean, is this any more than just a kind of greatest hits with the speed of light thrown in there for good measure?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's been funny is the amount of pity that people direct towards certain parts of the galaxy that are listening to music that they don't happen to like that much. So there's a lot of like, oh, like those like poor Andromedans, like they're stuck listening to this right now. Like just looking at it as like, oh, we shouldn't have like bombarded all these signals on all these people, sort of feeling bad about our cultural contributions.
So the idea that, you know, you just it goes out into the heavens and it's lost for all time, that it's suddenly like, no. Actually, it's more like Facebook. You post it and it's around forever.
Yeah, I guess scientifically with the law of inverse squares, it technically doesn't travel all that discernibly for more than a few light years. But I think just the fact that the energy waves from Mambo Number 5 are still going out there is a little troubling to humanity.
The energy waves from Mambo Number 5.
Yeah.
Yeah, where are they now?
20 light years?
20 light years.
I'm not sure when Mambo Number 5 came out.
So what tune inspires you in terms of Earth's hopeful message to the rest of the universe?
That's a good question. I mean, to me, I kind of like the idea that we're bombarding out frivolous pop hits into the universe. I think a lot of the times, you know, we try to lead into the universe with this very, like, very respectable face. Like, we put the gold plate in Voyager that makes us look very, you know, kind and cerebral. But I think it's kind of nice that we're just, you know, sending Rebecca Black out into space. And I think it's kind of nice that it's, you know, Fetty Wap is, like, our way of talking to the galaxy. I think it gives us sort of a more realistic picture of who we are to the galaxy.
And that's a good thing?
I mean, I think if aliens arrive, we might as well, you know, be honest with them.
Yeah. If you want to see where your favorite song is now in the universe, just go to lightyear.fm. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Locker is the creator of lightyear.fm, and we'll leave you now with the sound of the first radio broadcast back in 1910, the great Enrico Caruso, whose voice can now be heard all across the Milky Way galaxy with a width of, that's right, 105 light years. Sing it, Enrico. If you could greet our friends in the universe through radio waves, what would you want them to hear? Or what broadcast would scare them off, do you think? Here are your thoughts. Weymouth, Massachusetts. Anything with a Kardashian should be used as a defense to repel visitation by aliens. I think that's already working. Bluffton, South Carolina. I would want them to hear JFK's moon speech delivered 9/12/1962 at the Rice Stadium.
My name is Mac. I'm from Downingtown, Pennsylvania. And if there was one address that I would like aliens to hear, it's FDR's address to Congress, December 1941. He's the last president and the last Congress that really meant it when they promised to destroy those who would attack us.
No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
Join this conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's our number. Much more at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills like Swedish, statistics, and sword fighting. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
My dad, when we started out, he didn't know what I was doing. He just knew that I shook and that I was in clubs.
Maysoon Zayed is funny and fearless.
So he asked me, are you a stripper? And when he found out that I wasn't stripping, he was ecstatic. He was like, okay, just telling jokes and your pants are on? I was like, yeah. My mom, she's not against my career. She's super critical. So
really?
I'll go on 60 Minutes, and whereas like other parents would be like, you did a great job. I'm so proud of you. My mother would be like, your hair, it was not nice.
Maysoon, the not stripper with the not nice hair, is actually a successful comedian who likes to make fun of Muslims, and she's not alone.
Anything on a plane is a weapon to a Muslim, all right? The corner of a Dorito chip can slice a neck, all right? You think that seat cushion is a flotation device? You are wrong. That is a smothering pillow. You see a sky mall, I see a paper-cut katana.
Look,
That's Hasan Minhaj from The Daily Show, who might say Allah makes him funny.
If you wait a minute, you'll see one of our Latino Muslim brothers, right? Growing segment of our community. Assalamu alaikum. Wa alaikum salam. ¿Cómo estás, hermanito? ¿Qué fajalak? Alhamdulillah, I like being Muslim, man. You guys like enchiladas. Because you always say enchilada.
The actual name of this successful comedy troupe is Allah Made Me Funny. And in between Amy Schumer YouTube videos, you might find yourself watching the online sitcom Halal in the Family.
I get so nervous, you know?
Just speak from your heart.
Exactly. Just downplay the Muslimy thing.
Asif?
He actually has a Muslim birth certificate, and white people are obsessed with finding those things.
Starting tonight in New York City, more than 15 Muslim stand-up comedians from around the world are taking part in the first-ever Muslim comedy festival. Muslim Funny Fest is led by Maysoon Zayed, an actress and comic who, when her ethnic jokes aren't working, can fall back on making fun of the cerebral palsy she's lived with all her life, and Dean Obadalla, an attorney-turned-comic who now has his own Sirius XM show. They both find plenty of material in their own lives.
When I was a younger comic, I did a lot more of that sex and fart jokes because I relied on it. Now, I'll drop one in here and there just for shock value, but predominantly I like to talk about my family. I love to talk about pop culture, and I like politics much more than talking about sex, but I'll do a tampon joke here and there just to keep it lively.
Just variety.
And you won't do.
I'm not doing any tampon jokes. That's I probably won't do safe. Any sex jokes, but yeah. I will talk about relationships. I'll even make fun of certain parts of Islam in a way, at least the way that we practice it and oversay things like inshallah in America and in the Middle East, as you know, someone being there. And I think that's something that would shock most Americans, that you can actually do jokes about Muslims and about Islam a little, and Muslims are going to laugh. They're not going to protest and burn the place down.
I do a joke about Mecca that's like super controversial, and I've been doing it for a couple of years. And it's a joke I heard on the street. It's not my own joke. And I've never had a negative backlash from doing the joke because people get it's a joke.
And the joke is?
I don't know if it translates because it's in Arabic, but I will try.
Well, let's just hear it.
Anyway. Okay, shortcut of the joke. Yeah. A guy goes to Mecca. He's got his mother-in-law, his wife, and his mom. And he's walking around praying, and he sees his mother-in-law saying, "God forgive me, my daughter who's with me is not my husband's child." He sees his mother, and she says, "God forgive me, my son who brought me a hajj is not my husband's child." And he sees his wife holding her stomach, and she goes, "God forgive me, the baby in my stomach is not my husband's." And he stops, and he goes, "God forgive me, I brought you three sluts to Mecca." So it's misogynistic and against Islam all at once. So I've offended my women fans, I've offended pregnant people, and I've offended Islam.
And what could be more entertaining than that?
But see,
in Arabic, it's even better.
What's cool about that joke is I'm not making fun of Islam. I'm just making a joke.
Yeah.
You know, it's not mocking the religion. It's mocking the fact that out of the million people running around, most of them are sinners.
Is that true?
I don't believe in sin, so I have no idea.
God, that's horrible. What are the opportunities in American television right now to tell story? I mean, we've seen a lot of shows, series that really go places that Americans haven't seen typically on TV. I mean, you know, Orange is the New Black is my kid's favorite show.
It's a good show.
Yeah, it's a good
show.
Watch it.
I fear prison.
I love
prison.
That show. It needs to be a Muslim prisoner, though.
Yeah. Well, you should have feared in prison.
I do.
If you're
I
a
fear
Palestinian.
Imprisonment.
Yeah.
They're all, exactly. Yeah. I'm Palestinian and I'm disabled. You know, I'd be made into a pet the first day.
So what do you think the opportunities are in television right now?
Limited. Extremely limited. It's interesting, though, because Muslims don't all look alike. So you could get cast on anything in TV, be Muslim, and have them not know. You know, so unless you out yourself as a Muslim, it's not going to eliminate jobs for you. But as far as characters that are written as Muslim, we're only seeing one-dimensional. Either the good, helpful Muslim who's helping the FBI or taxi driver terrorist. Bundled in one.
The good Muslim usually gets killed later by the bad Muslims because they work with the government. So, but to us, though, the issue really is not as much as casting. It's about being able to tell our story or get our story out there. Mainstream media, I'm going to be honest, cable news very rarely shows positive Muslims, shows Muslims denouncing terrorism. You know, American TV, you see Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and Muslims under arrest. Those are the three types of Muslims we basically see right now. And that's the struggle because we're defined so much by the worst examples by far. And it's not unique to our community. African Americans, Latinos will tell you the exact same thing. So we don't really have the counterbalance of the good black guy or the good Latino woman. We have all negative almost, really with few exceptions.
Is the internet more of an opportunity to present that to American audiences?
One of the comedians in the festival, Hisham Faghi, who is our comedian who's coming in from Saudi, he uses the internet extensively to do sketch. So does Rami Youssef. And Hisham had a video called No Woman, No Drive about women not driving in Saudi.
In this bright future, you can't forget your past. So put your car key away. No woman, no drive.
And he got over 13 million hits.
That's great.
And imagine he made that in Saudi and was able to get all of that, you know.
And that's some of the political, that's funny, that's like a political comic in a way in Saudi Arabia pushing up against the rules saying women can't drive. And he did do a parody to No Woman, No Cry. And it's great, it's funny, and it's very daring because those guys are risking going to jail.
But because it's reggae, the Saudis leave it alone. They're terrible.
They don't understand it.
I don't think they understood it. They so let's not translate it. If they ever ask you, just say that it's praising the monarchy.
I like the catchy, very catchy. I like what you're doing there. They have no idea what the words are, hopefully.
I can't go there, but you can.
Of course we can. That's the beauty of this.
Yeah, he's done shows in Saudi. Yeah.
Dean and Maysoon, thank you so much. This is great.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
The Muslim Funny Fest kicks off tonight in New York City and runs for 3 nights. Dean Obadallah and Maysoon Zayat are the co-producers of the festival. And here's something to take with you today, a little story of the power of disclosure and non-disclosure online. Who out there is worried about the hacking of the dating website Ashley Madison? Raise your hands. Right. That will happen. The site dedicated to people who want to have extramarital affairs secretly is going to have a problem if its client list is disclosed to the public. That's what the hack apparently has done. But the British government thinks there's no problem in forcing businesses with more than 250 employees to publicly disclose information on the average pay of their male and female workers. Talk about the water cooler from that one? Oh, yeah. A lot of water cooler talk. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us about the pay gap at your business. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can ask anything to me on Twitter every day. I take your questions, sometimes your complaints, and do my best to get back to you personally. Again, you can tweet your questions to me at Jay Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.